The Doris Duke Foundation.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Spider Art Constructors, offering hardscaping across the KPR listening area, including patios and retaining walls. More information about creating your backyard oasis is at Spider Art, Spider with a Y, SpiderArtConstructors.com.
62 degrees in Lawrence, 63 in Topeka. It is 6:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. With a little more than a day to go until voting ends, Vice President Harris is narrowly leading former President Trump among likely voters. That's according to an NPR PBS News Marist poll out today. But her lead is within the margin of error, and that means this race remains incredibly close. The new polling also gives us a better understanding of some trends we've been following this election cycle. Here to explain all of this and what it might mean as we head into Election Day is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Domenico, we've talked a whole bunch this election cycle. You've told us over and over again that this race is super close. So tell us what stands out to you in today's poll.
And still close. One thing that jumped out to me, though, were the responses to a question we asked about whether the candidates are mainly making proposals they intend to carry out if elected, or if they're putting them forward just to get people to vote for them. Now, 55% said that Trump intends to carry out his promises, whether they like them or not. But for Harris, likely voters were split 49-49. And I think this is really notable because it might tell us why she hasn't closed the deal with some voters. You know, it's been a hurdle for her to try and overcome her words and promises that she made during her presidential campaign 5 years ago when she was trying to court progressives. This has been a concern for her campaign because lots of voters continue to say they don't quite know her or what she stands for, despite what she's said very clearly in this campaign. And the Trump team has been happy to try and help them make up their minds with a relentlessly negative ad campaign over the past month against Harris.
Domenico, I find this super interesting. Anything notable in how different sorts of voters responded to that question?
Yeah, we saw a gender divide on who thought Harris was being sincere. A majority of women thought Harris intended to do what she was proposing, which has been more moderate than what she'd put forward in 2019. But a majority of men thought the opposite. And there was a huge divide by education. White women with college degrees overwhelmingly thought Harris would follow through on her promises. But huge majorities of white men who didn't go to college thought she's just saying these things to get votes.
There's been a lot of talk about the gender gap in the closing days of election season and the thinking that this could be the widest in history. Does this poll bear that out?
To an extent, it does. I mean, overall, there's a 15-point gender gap between men and women in their support for Harris or Trump. Harris leads with women by 11. Trump leads with men by 4. That's actually smaller than last month's divide. So who knows exactly what it's going to be on election day? But what's been clear is that college-educated women are key to Harris's election hopes.
Okay, let's set aside gender for a second. What other demographic groups are you watching this election season, and what does the poll tell us?
Well, Harris is doing quite well with black voters in this survey and not far off from where she likely needs to be with Latino voters, too. And that could make a huge difference. 83% of black voters now say that they're with Harris. That's the highest since she's gotten into this race. So for all the talk about Trump siphoning off young black men, this is one good data point for Harris's team. Now, Harris is winning Latinos with 61%. And with Gen Z, she's at 56%. Those are a little short of where Democrats have been in the past when they've won. But remember, there's a wide margin of error here. It's bigger for subgroups in national polls. So it's not very far off from where Democrats have been when they've had success. Harris has to hope that the shift we're seeing with college-educated white voters in her direction, as well as baby boomers who say they're going to vote for her, could offset some of those potential losses. A light breeze in any of these directions, though, could change the outcome of who the next president of the United States is.
We will keep on watching. That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Former President Trump told NBC yesterday that removing fluoride from the water supply, quote, sounds okay to him. He was responding to a declaration from his ally Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's lined up to advise Trump on federal health policy, and Kennedy has spread misinformation about vaccines. As NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports, public health experts are alarmed.
Adding fluoride to water systems started in 1945 in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's been used widely since then to prevent tooth decay in children. In fact, the CDC has called it one of the 10 great public health achievements of the 20th century. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. explained his position on fluoride at an event with the New York Sun in September.
I think fluoride is a poison.
Over the weekend, he posted on X that on Inauguration Day, former President Donald Trump would advise all U.S. water systems to remove fluoride. He wrote, quote, "Fluoride is an industrial waste," unquote, and said it was associated with arthritis, IQ loss, thyroid disease, among other conditions. Not true, says Dr. Paul Offit of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
Fluoride's been well tested. It clearly and definitively decreases cavities and does not associate it with any clear evidence of the chronic diseases mentioned in that tweet.
Offit has written many books, including one about celebrities and politicians spreading debunked health information.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a science denialist. He makes up his own scientific truths and ignores the actual truths.
Kennedy is especially fervent in his advocacy against the use of vaccines, explains Offit.
Which diseases would he like to see come back? Polio, which, you know, caused up to 35,000 cases of paralysis a year and 1,500 deaths, or whooping cough, which would cause 8,000 children to die every year.
Kennedy on Monday posted a video urging his supporters to vote for Trump so he's elected with a strong mandate.
Then no one will be able to stop us when he empowers me to clean up corruption in the federal agencies, and especially our health agencies.
Those health agencies include the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, among others. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
There is one person who has worked with Michael Jackson and Frank Sinatra and Ray Charles. He wrote dozens of scores for film and TV and eventually produced movies and TV shows and got megastars together to sing We Are the World for charity. That would, of course, be Quincy Jones, who died last night at age 91.
Before he changed the course of popular music, he got his first big break in a jazz big band. Quincy Jones spoke with NPR's Michelle Norris in 2008. We pick up their conversation from when he was growing up in Chicago in what he called the heart of the ghetto.
Gangsters. Nothing but gangsters. Back in the 30s, it was all I ever saw were machine guns and stogies and big piles of money on the lights.
You saw all this?
That's all, as a kid, that's all I saw. I wanted to be a gangster till I was 11. Are you kidding?
In your book, you tell the story, you say that they pinned my hand to a wooden fence with a switchblade when
that's
I
right.
was 7 years old. Who was they? What
they
did they do
is
you?
Being on the wrong block. If you went on the wrong street and didn't have the right call, you get a switchblade through your hand. I was 7 years old.
And they literally pinned your hand to a fence?
Yeah, and it was a switchblade. Now, also, an ice pick in my temple. That's real fun.
They held it to your temple, or did
no,
they actually...
No, they stuck it in my temple.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. I got the scar right, but my medal's to prove it here.
How did you get out of Chicago?
Capone ran the Jones boys out because they didn't know they were making so much money. And they ran into Mexico, and my dad came and got my brother and I at the barbershop the next day and took us on a trailway bus, no toys, and went straight to the Northwest. He worked in the Bremerton Navy Yard during the World War II, and then we went to Seattle 2 years later.
Now, that's where you met up with Ray Charles.
That's right, exactly. Exactly, you got your homework
down. Well, you know, I did my homework.
You sure did.
I knew who I was going to be talking to.
I met Ray Charles at 14. He was 16, but he was like 100 years older than me.
Quincy, my buddy. My buddy. Quite so true.
How'd you meet?
We met, it wasn't like the film. We met up at the Elks Club. The Elks Club is where we all went after all of the paying jobs, whatever they were, whenever they came. That's where we went to just play bebop for jam all night for free.
Musically speaking, you've bridged so many genres and generations also. I understand that Lionel Hampton was the person who gave you your big break. I want you to tell me not just about Lionel Hampton, but also about Gladys Hampton, because I understand she stayed on top of you.
She was beautiful, absolutely beautiful. I was very upset, though, when I got thrown off the bus, so, because I really wanted to go on the road. That's all I cared about.
Thrown off the bus?
Honey, what's that child doing on here, Lionel? She said, honey, get off of this bus and go back to school. We'll talk later. And I sat on the bus for 4 hours so they wouldn't change their mind, and boy, it didn't happen.
Tell me the story.
At 15 years old, he saw a piece of music I'd written called Sweet for the Four Winds. I didn't know what I was doing. He wanted to hire me as a trumpet playing arranger, and I just jumped on the bus. I didn't want to tell my parents or anybody. I didn't want anybody to change their mind, because it had been my dream to be a member of a big band. And Lionel Hampton at that time was bigger than Duke Ellington, or Basie, and Louis Armstrong. They all worked with Joe Glazer at Associated Booking, and he was the number one band. He worked 300 days a year, you know. And it was the most exciting, educational, learning experience I've had in my life.
So you went back to Berkeley to study music. It wasn't called Berkeley at the time.
It was the Schillinger House of Music. That was a Russian mathematician. My teacher said, because you're going to learn everything everybody ever did with the 12 notes, from Stravinsky to Elvin Berg to Duke Ellington, everybody. I spent 28 years to hone my craft so I could write any kind of music. And I learned so much by working as a conductor and arranger for, you know, Billy Eckstein, Ray Charles, and Peggy Lee, with no pressure on me. And in those days, we didn't care about money or fame. We couldn't care less.
The music super producer Quincy Jones in conversation with NPR's Michelle Norris in 2008. His publicist says he died Sunday night at his home, surrounded by family.
Woman needs man, and man must have his mate that no one can deny. It's still the same old story.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence. Also at 91.3 FM in Junction City, 89.9 FM in Atchison, and lots of other frequencies, too. Always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming a cappella group Straight No Chaser in their Top Shelf Tour, Wednesday, November 13th, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available at lead.ku.edu.
Stay with us. News headlines coming your way in about 12 minutes. In our final half hour of All Things Considered, the presidential race appears extremely close. You probably knew that. A contested election could mean legal challenges and potentially political violence. We are going to learn more from Mary Louise Kelly and Paul Eaton. We'll continue our Unsung Heroes series, and we will talk about the difference between something that's improbable and impossible and some research that was done with children about this. It's all coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the Yoga Center of Lawrence, providing Lawrence and surrounding communities with yoga instruction by Iyengar yoga instructors since 1999. Class schedule and registration information at yogacenteroflawrence.org.
You can join us tomorrow night at 6 o'clock on your KPR One stations for NPR and KPR's coverage of Election Night 2024. Again, that is tomorrow night, 6 o'clock. We preempt the final hour of All Things Considered, or at least NPR is doing that. And we will have Jay Schaefer and Jim McLean on hand to wrap up the regional vote as well. 6 o'clock tomorrow night on your KPR One station.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. There are lots of places to follow election results tomorrow. Your local public radio station is one. Another is social media. Many of the biggest platforms are more lenient about what people can say than during the last presidential election. And that makes misinformation researchers nervous about the spread of lies or even violence. NPR tech correspondent Bobby Allen is here to tell us more. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Ari.
So how are social media companies preparing for the election?
Well, most of the big platforms say they'll be vigilant for any voter interference attempts and false claims of victory. And this will be through a mix of automated systems and human moderators. Google and Meta also are limiting the time frame when advertisers can buy new election ads. So most of the major tech companies say they do have guardrails in place to combat election-related bad actors. But as you mentioned, social media researchers are very skeptical. And this is because they have been noticing companies backing off of commitments and enforcing policies less. And a lot has changed since the last presidential election in 2020.
Tell us more about that. What's changed?
Well, the most obvious change is Twitter, now X. Elon Musk has transformed the platform into a megaphone for the re-election of Donald Trump. And with that has come droves of MAGA fans and very few content rules that would otherwise have taken down false claims about the election. But elsewhere, Ari, other platforms have also become lax. Studies have shown that YouTube has backed off enforcing prior commitments to crack down on videos pushing the big lie, the false idea that the 2020 election was stolen. And many YouTube, TikTok, and ex-provocateurs are going viral by seeding doubt about the 2024 result already. I talked to Marshall Van Alstyne about this. He studies social media at Boston University, and he's really worried about platforms enabling election-related conspiracy theories.
In some sense, they're greasing the skids for violence or greasing the skids for conspiracy theories. I'm hoping it's nothing of the same scale as what we observed in January 6th, but we may be seeing some bad behavior ex post as people believe that their votes weren't counted or that certain districts were stolen from them.
Is he talking about authentic posts by real social media users or paid ads or what?
Yeah, you know, really both, because ads have also been a problem. For instance, dark money groups have been spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on Facebook pushing ads with just outright brazen lies, like that the election might be postponed or that Kamala Harris could drop out.
There was so much misinformation in the last couple presidential elections. Why would the rules be looser now than they were then?
Yeah, counterintuitive, isn't it? It's just really hard, Ari, to overstate just how much of a ripple effect Elon Musk's X has had in terms of, you know, setting the tone for all the platforms. Researchers say X has become something of a free-for-all with, you know, very few consequences from Washington. And that has given other social media sites permission to just be looser with their rules. In fact, this tech reform group called the Free Press released a study just days ago, and it found that nearly all of the social media platforms are, quote, backsliding on commitments they made in the wake of the 2020 election. So that's been concerning to social media researchers. And another concern, Ari, is the encrypted messaging app Telegram. We're seeing very large groups there forming to discuss ways of questioning the outcome of the presidential election. And Telegram is another app known for its handoff approach to content moderation. So in short, be very careful on social media tomorrow and after the election.
Will do. NPR's Bobby Allen. Thank you.
Thanks, Ari.
In his third run for the White House, former President Donald Trump is once again delivering a closing message that promises a stronger economy and a strong border. But mixed in that is a darker message with a lot of anger and promises of revenge and retribution, calling political opponents the, quote, enemy within. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has this report on the evolution of Trump's closing argument.
At an extremely late final rally in Grand Rapids, Michigan, back in 2016, then-candidate Donald Trump called for a middle-class rebellion before turning to his bread-and-butter issue.
I just want to ask you one question, if you don't mind, at 1 o'clock in the morning. Who is going to pay for the wall?
4 years later, soon after recovering from COVID, 100%. Trump returned to Grand Rapids, where he minimized the dangers of the pandemic and complained about the investigations against him.
We've worked very hard in 4 years. We've been hit by fake investigations, fake scandals, fake impeachments. We've had so many things that the witch hunt. I call it the witch hunt.
But now, ahead of his third trip to Grand Rapids, his rhetoric has turned even darker, and it's more focused on domestic enemies. This weekend, he said he wouldn't mind if reporters were shot, and doubled down on suggestions that Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney should have to face gunfire in combat.
But if you gave Liz Cheney a gun and put her into battle facing the other side with guns pointing at her, she wouldn't have the courage or the strength to even look the enemy in the eye.
Let me just say that emotions are always high at the end of a campaign. Candidates on both sides are known to push the limits. But Trump's violent imagery and focus on domestic enemies, while thrilling supporters, has political scholars drawing comparisons to former strongmen of the past.
I hear a lot of echoes of Mussolini's fascism in Trump's rhetoric.
Jennifer Mercia is a professor at Texas A&M University who studies political rhetoric. She says Trump's language has intensified, and so have his promises. She notes several top military national security officials who worked in the Trump administration have raised similar concerns, including his former chief of staff, who said Trump meets the definition of a fascist.
These are people who worked with him closely. They know exactly what Trump is like because they were the ones that protected the rule of law and democracy in America when Trump was trying to violate those things.
The Trump campaign says the concerns about fascism are overblown and Biden and Harris are the real threat to democracy. They call these attacks dishonest attempts to discredit conservatives and their ideas. That's certainly how many of Trump's supporters feel.
It's nonsense. I'm the man on the street. We're in small town America, rural America, and it hurts, okay? The message doesn't resonate positively with me at all. It's negative.
Peter Fabry is a retired Cadillac designer. He says the accusations are an attempt by the Democrats to distract from a lack of policy solutions. He and his wife also run a small business in northern Michigan, which he says did well under Trump, but never fully recovered after COVID. He blames the Biden-Harris administration.
So those 4 years of Trump brought prosperity, and we were able to make money and put money in the bank. And then followed by the COVID and the 4 years with the Biden-Harris administration, we didn't make any money. We've been struggling.
And some Republican strategists, like Alex Conant, say don't let Trump's rhetoric distract from the policies.
When you look at his core platform, it's lower taxes, it's more restrictions on immigration, it's stronger national defense.
Conant, who helped lead Senator Marco Rubio's presidential campaign back in 2016, says the policy platform looks a lot like Mitt Romney's in 2012.
This is a very traditional conservative campaign, just with Donald Trump's more extremist rhetoric, which makes it different.
But that's when Trump stays on script. And when he closes out his campaign tonight in Grand Rapids for a third time, whether he stays on script or veers off may determine whether he distracts from his own final message. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, Grand Rapids, Michigan.
This is NPR News.
As Americans hold their breath awaiting the end of another contentious election, TV news executives say they are ready-ish.
We have really made a sincere effort to get out there around the country and to understand the electorate.
This story and analysis of all things election-related on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning, 5 to 9 a.m. on your KPR station. Start off your election day with the latest information. Jay Schaefer will be your local host.
Support for KPR comes from Wheatfield's Bakery and Cafe, featuring artisan breads baked daily in a wood-fired oven, breakfast and dessert pastries, as well as breakfast and lunch. Located at 904 Vermont Street in downtown Lawrence. Online at wheatfieldsbakery.com.
News headlines are up next. 61 degrees in Lawrence, 62 in Chanute. It is 6:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, the benefits of encountering the unexpected. For toddlers, anyway.
There was this really big learning boost for kids who had seen the impossible event.
Also, is the U.S. more prepared for a contested election than we were 4 years ago?
That story is after these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Vice President Kamala Harris is making a final sprint today through the battleground state of Pennsylvania, where she has five campaign stops. More than 79 million voters have cast their ballots so far. Pennsylvania has 19 electoral votes up for grabs tomorrow, the largest among the states expected to determine the Electoral College outcome. Harris urging supporters in Scranton to be intentional about building community and unity.
The way I've always been thinking about our campaign in these next 24 hours is, as we are getting out the vote, as we are canvassing, let's be intentional about building community, about building community, about building coalitions, about reminding people we all have so much more in common than what separates us. There is power in that. There is power in that.
Polls have the candidates virtually tied heading into Election Day, and at his second rally of the day, Republican Donald Trump spoke to voters in Reading, Pennsylvania, both campaigns working hard to win the swing state. But as NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben tells us, today's visit by Trump is also important because of the city's Latino population.
Trump has been trying to win Latino voters all year, a group that has historically leaned Democratic. But a pattern of offensive remarks about Latinos, including a recent joke about Puerto Rico, has threatened his standing with those voters. Reading is more than two-thirds Latino, and many of those voters have Puerto Rican heritage. Trump took the stage about 85 minutes late, and the arena was roughly half full throughout the rally. Trump gave what has become a standard rally speech, meandering to many topics, but promising in particular to conduct mass deportations and lower gas prices. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, Reading, Pennsylvania.
And on Wall Street today, stocks finished modestly lower ahead of Election Day. This is NPR News.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. A man has been charged with first-degree murder after investigators say he killed his wife and son Friday night following a standoff with police in Lenexa. According to the Johnson County District Attorney's Office, 53-year-old Todd Michael Donovan has been charged with two counts of first-degree murder after he allegedly shot and killed his wife, 52-year-old Sheila Donovan, and son, 22-year-old Tyler Donovan. WDAF-TV reports that Donovan is also facing one count of cruelty to animals. After investigators say he shot and killed his neighbor's dog on the same night, Todd Donovan is being held on $2 million bond. Hundreds of people in the state of Kansas are waiting for life-saving organ transplants. Jan Finn is CEO of the Midwest Transplant Network, which is the main organ procurement agency for Kansas and parts of Missouri. She says approximately 2,500 people in Kansas and Missouri are awaiting new organs. One of her group's main challenges is fighting misconceptions about organ donation.
We try to address those right off the bat, that they can have an open casket, that organ donation should not interfere with any final plans that they have. Organ donation does not cost anything to the donor family.
Finn says they try to combat negative stereotypes about organ donation, and for the most part, Kansans are receptive. She says most people in their service area are noted as organ donors on their driver's licenses. The Kansas City Chiefs, the only undefeated team in the NFL, will be lining up tonight against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at Arrowhead Stadium. Sam Zeff provided this preview.
The Bucs come into Arrowhead with a 4-4 record and a two-game losing streak, but in the last three games, Tampa Bay has had 300 yards passing and 100 yards rushing, which has defensive coordinator Steve Spagnuolo worried.
I keep waiting for a game when I put the film on and it's not a top offense we're playing. These guys are good. I'm really impressed with the three backs. The quarterback's playing really good.
Buccaneers quarterback Baker Mayfield has 21 touchdown passes this season and 9 interceptions. Patrick Mahomes has 8 TD passes and 9 picks. I'm Sam Zeff.
We do have a 60% chance of rain tonight, chance of storms, lows in the upper 40s tomorrow, mostly cloudy in the morning, but clearing as the day goes on with highs in the upper 50s. Tomorrow night, mostly clear with a low in the upper 30s. It's 6:35.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Just a few hours to go now before Election Day and determining who will be the next president of the United States. But with polls showing an extremely tight race, a narrow victory by either candidate could open up the possibility of a contested election. That could mean legal challenges or, more worrying, the possibility of post-election political violence like we saw on January 6th. After that failed attempt to subvert the election results, three retired U.S. generals wrote in the Washington Post, quote, "We are chilled to our bones at the thought of a coup succeeding next time." Next time as in now, as in 2024. Well, Army Major General Paul Eaton was one of the authors of that piece, and when I spoke to him today, I asked what lessons the military has learned since last time around.
Murphy's Law is, if it can go wrong, it will go wrong at the worst possible time. The notice to the military that 1-6 provided was we had some folks who, as veterans and a handful of active duty, behave badly.
Hmm.
We have gone deep into the psyche of the commands, and there's been a considerable effort to identify any notion of extremism, any notion that the oath that we all swore to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that is clearly understood, the chain of command is clearly understood, and that national and local security forces are to be counted upon to do the right thing.
Yeah.
We expect absolutely that will be the case.
To pick up on what you just raised about chain of command, the military, as you know better than anyone, is trained. Salute, you follow your orders. What happens in a scenario in which the military is trying to follow orders, but you have a contested election and more than one person may be claiming to be commander-in-chief?
Mary Louise, that is precisely the question that occurred when we were doing our own analysis. The notion that someone will declare victory early, that possibility has become more likely as we see the behaviors in President Trump. And at that point, we simply say, well, the election is underway. We have not counted all votes. And we expect that the executive branch and that all states' polling places and counting locations are going to be alert to that possibility, yet they will continue to drive on, count the votes, so that we can have a certifiable election.
So let me just ask directly the basic question of how worried are you? And I will frame that in this context. Other retired officers have been raising concerns around this year's election. One of them is another retired Army general who you probably know, Joe Votel. He just took part in a University of Pennsylvania study that gamed out the aftermath of a contested election. That report concluded, and I quote, "Civil unrest in the face of the 2024 presidential election and beyond is a realistic, if not likely, possibility." Realistic, if not likely. How does that line up against your expectations?
Yes, I do know Joe Votel, and he is one of our finest, most sober leaders. I admire him greatly, and I absolutely agree. It is a possibility. And we in the military, go to the worst case possibility. What's the worst that can happen? And then you organize and plan on how you will mitigate that. I expect our state and local law authorities are going to be thoroughly involved in this, as well as our National Guard throughout the nation. And I expect that federal forces, to include the military, are equally prepared and have planned for a the possibility that you could have civil unrest and it could be substantial.
You described the worst case scenario, that it's the job of the military to prep for the worst case. What's the best case? That the military is, we're just not thinking about them at all after the election because it's so not even in play?
Well, the military will always have a place to defend our vital national interest. And domestic security, I would say, is our vital national interest.
That is retired U.S. Army Major General Paul Eaton. General Eaton, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary Louise.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at Hidden Brain. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Brian Perkins. A few years ago, Perkins started using a cane to walk.
Now, the thing about walking with a cane is that you've only got one hand to carry stuff. And so this was just post-pandemic. I had dropped off a bunch of clothes at the dry cleaners to get done and had just gone back to pick them up. And I was sitting at the counter with my cane and I was paying and clearly had more than I could carry in one hand out. And this woman, she was sitting by the laundromat and looked at me and she said, "Do you need any help?" And I said, no, I've got it. And so I hobbled out to my truck and was just getting through putting it in the back seat when I turned around and I looked. And there she was, marching out of the dry cleaners with the rest of my laundry in her hands. And she put it in the truck and she looked at me and she said, "I know you. You've been helping people all your life. Now it's your turn. Accept it." And just like that, she walked away. Now, to be clear, I didn't know this woman. I had never met her, and I'd never seen her before. But her words had a ripple effect on my life. I learned that it was okay to accept help. And so, over the years, and it's been a few years, I've gone from being grateful to my one unsung hero to having a whole chorus of unsung heroes who've helped me in many little ways and made a difference in my life and learned that people like to help other people and that kindness is not something that's forgotten. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful.
Brian Perkins of Biddeford, Maine. You can find more stories of unsung heroes at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Midi Health, committed to providing a supported path to symptom relief for women in perimenopause and menopause, offering personalized virtual care. Learn more at joinmidi.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Among the things Florida is voting on is a proposal that would overturn the state's ban on most abortions after 6 weeks. Instead, it would guarantee the right to an abortion in the state constitution. Florida Republicans, including Governor Ron DeSantis, have made several attempts to thwart the proposed amendment. Here's Regan McCarthy of member station WFSU.
Caroline recently found herself in the middle of two quickly brewing storms. One came from political pushback to a story she shared about her abortion.
I was also packing up my house to evacuate for Milton.
Caroline is talking about Hurricane Milton, which crashed into Florida in early October. We're not using her last name to protect her safety. Back in 2022, when she was about 18 weeks pregnant, Caroline learned she had a brain tumor.
The best chance of survival would be with the chemo and radiation, and all I wanted to do was leave the neuro ICU and go home to my almost two-year-old girl.
Caroline's story was featured in a television ad supporting Florida's proposed abortion amendment.
The doctors knew if I did not end my pregnancy, I would lose my baby, I would lose my life, and my daughter would lose her mom. Florida has now banned abortion, even in cases like mine.
the Florida Department of Health took issue with that last line in a cease and desist letter sent to television stations airing the ad. Florida's current law bans most abortions after 6 weeks, but it includes exceptions, such as protecting the life of the pregnant person.
These are not real exceptions.
Dr. Chelsea Daniels works for Planned Parenthood in Miami.
A simple exception clause written by a politician without a medical background does not take into account how medically complex patients can be and how clinically nuanced different situations can be.
Supporters of the Florida's ban endangers women by making access to abortion harder and by creating confusion and fear for doctors. Opponents argue the proposed amendment would put pregnant people in danger, and they say it's the abortion advocates who are causing confusion.
Well, thank you so much.
Please. Republican Governor Ron DeSantis calls the amendment extreme.
There's a lot in this that is not something that most people would find acceptable. And regardless of even what the opinion on it is, you know, these are things that are just flat out wrong to put in a constitution.
The DeSantis administration is behind a series of efforts to thwart the amendment, such as an investigation into alleged petition fraud, including police knocking on the doors of some people who signed to get the proposal on the ballot, and an ad and website published by the state's Agency for Healthcare Administration that says the amendment, quote, threatens women's safety. Amendment supporters say this is all an effort to mislead voters, but DeSantis pushes back on that idea.
What it is it's providing information about what Florida law is and the resources that are available under that law. They don't like that because they're lying about what's in Florida law.
We aren't telling lies. We're talking about facts. We have the stories of Florida women who have been denied this kind of care.
Lauren Brinzell heads Floridians Protecting Freedom, the campaign behind the state's proposed abortion amendment.
Our plan is to share the stories and not fall into the trap that is getting distracted by counter narratives, because we know we're in the right here.
Florida's amendment needs 60% approval to pass. Abortion advocates see it as a chance to ensure abortion access not only for women in Florida, but for pregnant people throughout the Southeast. For NPR News, I'm Regan McCarthy in Tallahassee.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we bring you the latest on everything from the presidential race to what interest rates are doing. But we also share stories that take us into other people's lives.
You actually played your horn while they were inside your skull.
Absolutely. Doesn't everybody?
Listen for the unexpected with the news weekdays on Morning Edition.
You can hear Morning Edition Monday through Friday from 5 to 9 a.m. on your KPR stations. Tomorrow, your local host is Jay Schaefer.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Chamber Ensemble, featuring the Beaufort Winds and highlighting the works of Barber, Dvorak, and more. 4 p.m. November 17th at Lutheran Church of the Resurrection in Prairie Village, Kansas. Details at MidwestChamberEnsemble.org.
Thanks so much for tuning in this evening from the University of Kansas. This is Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 90.3 FM in Chanute, 99.5 FM in Manhattan. Lots of frequencies. Thanks to the generous contribution of listeners just like you. Stay with us. We have a bit more All Things Considered yet to come. At 7:01 on your KPR1 stations, news headlines followed by Stardate, then 2 hours of classical music with Destiny. If you're joining us on KPR2, up next, we have This American Life.
Support for KPR comes from the Lawrence Public Library, offering the New York Times and Washington Post online, Ancestry.com, and more. All available with a library card. Card information at lplks.org.
60% chance of rain tonight. Chance of thunderstorms. Lows in the upper 40s. Tomorrow mostly cloudy in the morning, becoming mostly sunny through the day. Highs tomorrow in the upper 50s. Grab a sweater on your way out the door to go and vote. It's 10 minutes before 7.
Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.
Control of the U.S. Senate could come down to voters in mostly red Montana. There, Democratic Senator John Tester is in a tight race with Republican challenger Tim Sheehy. Tester is the last last Democrat holding statewide office, on the same ballot, Montana voters are also deciding whether to amend the state's constitution to enshrine abortion protections. Montana Public Radio's Shaylee Rager took a road trip across the state.
Along the Yellowstone River sits Livingston, a picturesque gateway to Yellowstone National Park, and it's seen an influx of new residents like much of western Montana. That includes Katie Williams, who moved from South Dakota about 2 years ago.
I love it here.
Williams first spoke to Montana Public Radio about her views in early October. Back then, she was considering how to vote on a state ballot initiative to protect abortion access. While abortion remains legal in the state, voters will decide this election whether to guarantee abortion rights in the state constitution.
People are allowed to make their own decisions. You know, like even Jesus would have said, like, you free will, you have free choice.
On Tuesday, Williams plans to vote yes on that measure. Yet just this week, she said she doesn't plan to vote in the presidential election, saying she doesn't like any candidate and doesn't think it'll make a difference. Polls show former President Donald Trump is leading in Montana, a state he won by double digits in 2020 and 2016. Business owner and former Navy SEAL Tim Sheehy, boosted by an early endorsement from Trump, is the Republican candidate for Senate. For voters like Pete Liza in southwestern Ennis, that endorsement is important. The Army veteran retired from the Boston Fire Department and moved to Montana 10 years ago. He said he wanted to live in a more conservative state and can't believe how tight the Sheehy tester contest is.
And I'd like to see Sheehy win.
Liza said Sheehy and the GOP represent his values well.
I just think that I've been for the flag, for the country, and I just think one party represents that a lot better than the other.
Questions about the origins of a gunshot wound have trailed Sheehy since last spring. He says he was wounded while serving in Afghanistan, but 2015 records show he told a park ranger he'd accidentally shot himself in a national park. Democrats often point to that discrepancy, saying Sheehy isn't trustworthy. Polls show that Sheehy is ahead of Tester. If Tester, a three-term incumbent, is to win this cycle, he needs voters like the Livingston voter, Williams. She's not sold on either party. Williams says she decided in the past few weeks to vote for Tester. She says she wants
someone that you can trust and that's an honest person, because you don't find that a lot in politics.
Democrats are hoping that the ballot initiative to protect abortion access will also help turn out voters in his favor. Heading north to Montana's capital city, Helena, the Last Chance Community Powwow took place last month. Rose Butler of Cherokee and Shawnee Heritage drove over from Deer Lodge, about an hour away. Butler is originally from Anaconda, a former copper mining town with once strong unions. She said her parents were loyal Democrats.
My dad always told me if you sweat for a living, you vote Democrat. But seeing where the Democrat Party has went, he'd be rolling over in his grave.
But she credits Tester for caring about the same issues she cares about, like access to public lands and protecting veterans' health care.
My husband's a vet. He's had better care under Tester than, you know, any other person that was out there handling things.
Butler was leaning towards Tester last month, but now she plans to vote for Sheehy in person on Tuesday, as well as Trump. She said she wants to see Republicans gain a majority in the Senate to help pass Trump's priorities if he wins. For NPR News, I'm Shaylee Rager in Helena, Montana.
Chances are you will never eat green eggs and ham. It's improbable, though not impossible. Now, there's evidence that even toddlers can tell the unlikely from the unimaginable. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
Infants know that when a ball rolls off a table, it's certain to fall. But a team, including Lisa Feigenson of Johns Hopkins University, wondered how children assess events that are less predictable.
We wanted to know how little kids think about possibilities.
The team studied more than 300 2- and 3-year-olds. Feigenson says the first challenge was getting their attention.
But it turns out that the opportunity to, like, put a little coin into a machine and get a prize is very naturally motivating to kids.
So the scientists filled the gumball machine with toys and started handing out coins. When a toddler got a toy, they were told it had a made-up name, like Blick. Later, they were asked to identify the Blick from a lineup. Feigenson says when the toddlers knew the machine contained even one or two Blicks, they usually forgot its name.
Any time that it was possible that something could happen, even if it was really improbable, those kids learned quite poorly.
But Feigenson says the result was different when toddlers got a Blick from a machine that appeared to have none.
The really gratifying moments are when kids' eyes widen and their jaws drop and they look at their mom in surprise that this has happened.
It seemed impossible. And then, she says, they usually did remember the Blick's name.
There was this really big learning boost for kids who had seen the impossible event. Those kids are, like, really motivated to learn about that toy.
The study appears in the journal PNAS. Andrew Stolman of Occidental College says it confirms that even very young children learn better when they encounter the unexpected.
It elicits a level of surprise that leads to more attention, better encoding of the events, and better retention of those events later on.
But Stolman says kids are less able to distinguish improbable from impossible events when there's no physical evidence, just a concept, like green eggs and ham.
And the youngest children say all of the events could not happen in real life. Anything that violates their expectations, they deny is possible.
Overall, though, Stolman says this sort of research contains a powerful message.
Maybe if you want children to learn something deeply and for a long time, you violate their expectations prior to introducing that information.
Once they understand how an event occurred, though, they tend to lose interest. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Speaking of improbable versus impossible, here's a familiar thought experiment. If you had an infinite number of monkeys with typewriters, or one monkey with infinite time, would they eventually type out the complete works of William Shakespeare?
This is 1,000 monkeys working at 1,000 typewriters. Soon, they'll have written the greatest novel known to man.
The Simpsons pondered this, so did two mathematicians from the University of Technology, Sydney, in Australia. Stephen Woodcock and Jay Folletta calculated that, based on the current chimpanzee population, it almost certainly wouldn't happen before the universe is expected to collapse.
Their paper in the journal Franklin Open says the widely accepted conclusion from the infinite monkeys theorem is misleading in our finite universe. In fact, the authors found just a 5% possibility that a single chimp would spell out the word bananas within its lifetime.
Which, I guess, itself is kind of bananas.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from National Geographic Documentary Films, presenting Endurance. Endurance follows a team of modern-day explorers who face the Herculean task of finding Sir Ernest Shackleton's famous sunken ship, now streaming on Hulu and Disney+. From Easy Cater, working to help organizations order food online from a nationwide network of restaurants, with tools designed to help save time and manage food spend, all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
We're in the final stretch of this historic election season. I'm Scott Detrow. Join us for live special coverage of Election Night 2024 from NPR News.
You will hear that coverage beginning at 6 o'clock tomorrow night on KPR. Your local hosts will be Jay Schaefer and Jim McLean. Join NPR and KPR for special live coverage of Election Night 2024.
Support for KPR comes from the Hall Center for the Humanities, presenting The Atlantic senior editor Van Newkirk Jr. discussing environmental impacts on marginalized communities. November 14th at the Lawrence Public Library. Details at lplks.org.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio.
KPR's Community Spotlight is now accepting applications from local nonprofits who need help spreading awareness about their mission. We'll highlight your organization for a month using KPR's airwaves. Details at kansaspublicradio.org.
Stay tuned. News headlines are up next, followed by count 'em, 2 hours of classical music with Destiny, tonight featuring the beautiful Blue Danube and much, much more. We do have a 60% chance of rain tonight, chance of thunderstorms, lows in the upper 40s, mostly cloudy tomorrow morning, becoming mostly sunny with highs tomorrow in the upper 50s. The time is 7:01. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The final NPR PBS News Marist poll is out, and it finds a close race, with women more likely to say they are voting for Vice President Harris and men siding with former President Donald Trump. NPR's Domenico Montanaro reports on how men and women also perceive Harris differently.
Harris leads 51-47 with likely voters, up 2 points from last month. When people were asked if they think Harris intends to follow through on her campaign proposals or if she's just putting them forward to help her win votes, they're evenly split 49-49. There's a sharp divide by gender and education on the question. 67% of white women with college degrees say she intends to do what she's proposing, but 67% of men without college degrees say she's not. The result reflects Harris's struggle in this campaign in getting past her words and promises that she made the last time she ran for president 5 years ago when she was trying to win over progressives. Domenico Montanaro, NPR News, Washington.
Former President Donald Trump is campaigning in Pennsylvania today in Reading, Pennsylvania, where the crowd responded with a resounding no when Trump asked attendees whether they were better off now than 4 years ago. Trump noting that's how long he's been waiting to return to the White House.
Think of this, though. We're just one day away. Oh, we've been waiting for this. I've been waiting 4 years for this. And so have you. And so have you. We've all been waiting 4 years. One day.
Trump calling the 2024 election the most important political event in the history of our country. Republican candidate is in Pittsburgh tonight. His Democratic rival, Vice President Kamala Harris, is also in Pennsylvania today. All 435 seats in the House of Representatives are on the ballot, but only about 15% of those contests are considered competitive. NPR's Deidre Wall says it may take days to know which party will have the majority.
House races in a couple of largely blue states, California and New York, could determine which party has control of the chamber. And it may take a while to count ballots in some of the tight California contests. Republicans hold a narrow majority, and Democrats need to pick up a total of 4 seats to tip the balance. House Speaker Mike Johnson is predicting full GOP control of Washington, with Trump in the White House and Republican majorities in both the House and Senate. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries has been more cautious, but if Democrats prevail in the chamber, he's positioned to become the nation's first black Speaker of the House. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, Washington.
China's launched a formal complaint with the World Trade Organization over tariffs put in place by the EU against the country's electric vehicles. China's government subsidizes its EV industry, allowing Chinese makers to put cheaper EVs on the market. The EU announced last week it was imposing import duties of up to 35% on electric vehicles from China. On Wall Street, the Dow fell 257 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Learn more at templeton.org. This is Kansas Public Radio.
Stardate November 4th. It's hard to imagine a less comfortable place for life than the clouds of Venus. They're made mainly of sulfuric acid, something you wouldn't want to dip your fingers into. Yet studies in the past few years are raising at least the possibility that microscopic life could inhabit those clouds. There's almost no way for anything to live on the surface of the planet. The atmosphere is too hot, dense, and toxic. But the clouds are about 30 miles high, where the conditions are more like those on Earth. A few years ago, scientists reported finding phosphine in the clouds. On Earth, it's a compound that's almost always produced by living organisms. Other studies have found no trace of it. But earlier this year, astronomers reported finding new evidence of the compound. Another study this year reported finding ammonia. On Earth, it's produced mainly by living organisms and industrial processes. And yet another study said that some of the key building blocks in amino acids could survive in a high concentration of sulfuric acid. None of that means that anything actually lives in the clouds. But it does mean that scientists will be taking a much closer look at Venus's clouds in the years ahead. Venus is the brilliant evening star. It's quite low in the southwest as night falls. Tonight, it's close to the upper right of the crescent moon. It'll be a little farther to the lower right of the moon tomorrow night. Our web address is stardate.org. For the University of Texas at Austin McDonald, I'm Billy Henry.
Support for Stardate on KPR comes from the University of Kansas Libraries, advancing research, teaching, and learning at the intersection of people and ideas. Info on community resources and upcoming events is at lib.ku.edu. Monday, friends. The Blue Danube Waltz here on KPR by Johann Strauss II. That recording was with the Philly Orchestra and Eugene Ormandy. A hint about what is to come. I am your host, Destiny. Really glad you are kicking off your week, evening of the week, with me. Hope you all are having a really great start to your week. At around 7:50, I have another hint that hints towards the rest of the week. Something rather, almost like being at a zoo, but not quite zoo-like. Think of another word for that. I hope you all had a really lovely Halloween. I can't believe it's already November. Wow. That means it's time to think about Christmas. Of course it is. Guess what? Big Band Christmas is Saturday night, December 14th at Liberty Hall. Have you gotten your tickets yet? I hope so. It would be fun to see you there. What better way to celebrate than with the KC Jazz Orchestra and special guests? I'm telling you, it's a good show. If you haven't been there before, it's pretty fun. Get your tickets while they last. They do sell out at Liberty Hall and at Ticketmaster.com, and always more to be found out at KansasPublicRadio.org. Well, I opened with the Blue Danube because I thought it was a perfect segue into a Mozart symphony that we are about to hear that actually premiered on this day in 1783. His symphony number 36, the Linz Symphony, and guess what borders Linz? Why? The Blue Danube does. So perfect, perfect segue. Let's enjoy it together right now on KPR. It's in the happy key of C major. It's about 30 minutes long. It's with Sir Colin Davis and the Staatskapelle Dresden here on Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you.
Mozart's Symphony No. 36, The Linz, here on KPR with Sir Colin Davis and the Staatskapelle Dresden. Awesome, indeed. Mozart is a great way to start our Monday. It sort of clears the mind, gets us ready for the rest of the week. You know what doesn't clear the mind? Alcohol. But you can get some really good alcohol from the Green Lady Lounge and jazz music. They are awesome supporters of KPR. That was supposed to be a funny segue. I hope you thought it was funny. They offer live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. And they are located at 1809 Grand Boulevard in Kansas City. You can find out more info at greenladylounge.com. So I did mention that at around this time, I was going to play for you something that would hint towards the rest of the week. And well, not that we live in a zoo or anything, but I thought Dvorak's Carnival Overture would be very fitting to get us ready for all of the crazy that will be happening tomorrow and from there on out. But you know what? Classical music can save the world. So let's enjoy it right now together. It's with Seiji Ozawa and the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Dvorak's Carnival Overture on KPR. Thank you. Dvorak's Carnival Overture here on KPR to close our evening with the Boston Symphony Orchestra and Ozawa. Good luck out there tomorrow, fellow humans. I will see you soon. Classics Live is up next on KPR.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. Any good news organization should bring you points of view that you agree with and points of view that you don't. Facts you approve and facts that make you uncomfortable. Our job is to bring you the full picture in context so you can decide. This is NPR.
This is Kansas Public Radio. Support for classical music on KPR comes from I2S at KU. Addressing the social impacts of emerging technologies and how to be human in a technologically complex age. More info is at i2s-research.ku.edu. You have the power to make a lasting positive influence in your community through planned giving. If KPR has been important to you, please consider a planned gift to the station. For more info, contact your financial advisor or visit legacy.kansaspublicradio.org. It's Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas for KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Ellsberg Junction City 91.3, and KANQ Chanute at 90.3. Listen online at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio.
Welcome to Classics Live. I'm Cordelia Brown with Destiny and friends for a very special Halloween show. We're in the pavilion of the Lead Center of Kansas, about to hear some great Halloween stories and some spooky music provided by Kansas Public Radio's own classical evening host, Destiny Ann Mermagan. Stay tuned for a bit of the Bach Toccata and Fugue in D minor, courtesy of pianist Karen Savage. Percussionist John Curry will provide spine-tingling musical effects. And Destiny's violin student, Evelyn Holmes, will share her own flourish from Paganini's Witch's Dance. Here's KPR's program director, Daryl Brogdon, to welcome them on stage now, here at the Pavilion of the Lead Center.
And now to close out Live Day 2023 on Kansas Public Radio, please welcome Destiny Ann Mermagan and friends.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a very spooky evening classical. I am your host, Destiny, but tonight I am a different host. I am your narrator of a very terrifying story of the cast of characters of Halloween. Does a tragic fate await them at the hands of a very spooky ghost? Let's find out. We start with the witches and the pumpkins. And now the giggling goblins come out to play as they frantically prepare the way for the ghostly ghouls to appear. ¶¶ The ghosts have arrived. Spooky in their character and magical in their powers, they attempt to summon a very special ghost from his grave. The bell doth toll as the end of the night nears. Who is this special ghost from his grave? Why, it's Johann Sebastian Bach! He's risen from the grave to send all of the cast of characters of Halloween back to theirs. Bach is here, and our characters of Halloween have met their fate, death. But why? Well, they stole all of Bach's Halloween candy. And so, in a murderous rampage due to low blood sugar, he murdered them all! And now we have their funeral. But even in a dreary funeral, like the weather outside this evening. There are moments of peace and sweetness.
Thank you. For historical purposes, Bach was not actually a murderer. He was a very kind and spiritual man, and so in that thought, we have decided to conclude this Halloween suite with a lullaby of the spirits to woo them off into a peaceful dreamland, probably just like Bach would have wanted.
Thank you so much, everybody. I would say let's give a big round of applause to Karen, our magnificent pianist, for her rendition of Bach's Toccata and Fugue. Well, now this is my normal voice, so... I tried to have my scary voice at the beginning. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here and braving the rain and joining us for this Halloween-themed evening. If you notice, we have an amazing array of toys over there and a fantastic musician playing all of them. And I have to say, this entire suite that we just played didn't have any percussion scored for it. So all of this creativity is from John Curry. And I want to tell you just a little bit about him. I'm going to plug him because, you know, musicians, we don't like plugging ourselves. We have to have someone else do it. His website, that's right, get a pencil, is John Curry, Curry with an E, .com. And he is a part of the Mexican marimba band Sol de Chiapas, the salsa band La Señora KC, and Ensemble Iberica, which some of you probably know. They've played on KPR before. So I was hoping, John, you could tell us a little bit about how you decide what to pick out, and people really want to know what that thing screaming at the beginning was.
Oh, yeah, no, I'd be glad to. So, no, it's, I'm a percussionist, so a lot of it has to do with just loving to play with toys, and literally, that's kind of what it is. I mean, if you went to, if you go to Union Station and you go to the gift shop after, you can find this thunder tube that we had involved. Right, so over here we have what was originally would be the jawbone of a donkey with the teeth tied back into it to rattle. This is a manufactured version. It's called a vibraslap. Yeah. From the old Foley days before everything was recorded and electronic, this is called a flexitone for the ghostly sounds. Yeah. I've got just a couple of suspended, kind of strung up sets of shells here for the goblin bone kind of rattle. Yeah, so it's just stuff here and there. Of course, the ghost, and this is called a Mark tree. It's said to have been invented by someone named Mark for a studio gig, and so that's where the name came from. We kind of call them wind chimes, right? And then finally, this spooky instrument right here. This is called an Aztec death whistle. There's several versions of the story about it, but the one I like most for Halloween is that the high priest would enchant these with the screams of the human sacrifices so that the warriors, the Aztec warriors, could take them into battle, play them in front of their enemies, and strike terror and horror and fear into their enemies. And that would give them an advantage in war. So the Aztec death whistle.
It's so great. You know, when we had our first rehearsal together, I like to say that I was a kid at Christmas time because it made the music so fun. I mean, every single thing he did was like, oh, wow. So thank you. I hear you have a bad joke you want to share.
Oh, yeah. Little. This one kind of ties into one that we kind of heard off air ahead of things there. Yeah, just a little bit to put you in the Halloween spirit. Why wouldn't the skeleton cross the road? Because he didn't have the guts.
Thank you so much, John.
A pleasure being here, Destiny. Thank you so much.
Yay. So much love on stage. I love it. Next, this is crazy. I'm going to play a really hard piece of music for the violin. It's called the Devil's Trill Sonata. Sorry, there's no percussions.
Oh, that's my cue to leave.
No. And the reason it's called this is, there are lots of reasons, but I do want to read to you Tartini. This is from the 1700s, actually around the time this violin was made, so maybe this music was even played on it. Tartini says of this Devil's Trill Sonata, "One night I dreamed I had made a bargain with the devil for my soul. I gave him my violin to see what he could do with it. How great was my astonishment to hear him play with such consummate art and intelligence, a sonata more exquisitely beautiful than anything I had conceived in my boldest flights of fantasy. I felt enraptured, transported, spellbound. My breath failed me, and I awoke. At once, seizing my own violin, I tried to retain the sounds I had heard in my dream, but it was in vain. The music I then composed is indeed the best that I have ever written, and I call it the Devil's Sonata. But it is so inferior to the one I heard in my dream that it would have destroyed my instrument, bidding farewell to music forever if it had not been possible for me to live without the enjoyment it gives me." Now, this last part about wanting to smash our instruments up against a wall when we play this, it's true. True story. I will summarize a little bit what's going on here. You'll hear a lullaby in the opening, sort of the dream setting that you get. And this devil, I like to say he's a friendly, mischievous little devil, because we get to this next part that's a bit faster, and he announces himself, and then he's sort of bouncing and bopping around, and it's very cute. And then the next section is sort of interspersed dream states with a little bit more crazy. And in there, you'll start to hear trills, and that's where the violinist rapidly alternates their finger back and forth. It happens a couple of times, and then the entire last page of this is all trills. I had to go back to physical therapy when I started practicing. It's like, oh my God, this is hard. But it's a really beautiful, beautifully written sonata, and you basically get to hear the violin do its violin thing, accompanied by a wonderful pianist, Karen. So enjoy.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Well, I guess I'm still alive. I guess the devil kind of got me. That's a crazy piece of music, isn't it? Yeah. Show's over. Night. Just kidding. Wow. Yeah, I'm just going to catch my breath. So, you know, when Bach had his supposed low blood sugar murderous rampage, he actually he let one witch go free because she was kind enough to share her candy with him to stop him from continuing his crazy rampage. And that witch is here with us. Come up to the stage, my lovely little witch. Yes, who do we have here? Oh, very spooky.
Hello, my pretties.
Wow, that was pretty good. That's my student. I didn't teach her to do that, though. This is my darling student, Evelyn, and I love incorporating youth into performances and playing with them and giving them opportunities to shine. I recently started a nonprofit called Prairie Classical that focuses on just that, giving youth performance opportunities. And Evelyn was my very first student when I came to Kansas City 6 years ago, but I think it was like a year before we met, and she's been studying with me ever since. And actually, one of the very first tunes we worked on out of the Suzuki book, if any of you took piano lessons as children, was Paganini's Witch's Dance. Ah, yes. And so that is going to be a real treat for you because we have the adult version coming. But Evelyn's been such a joy, and I promised her I'd buy her bubble tea afterwards if she said something nice about me on the air. So Evelyn, what do you really love about me?
Well, Miss Destiny, not only are you an amazing player and educator, as we all just heard, you've been such a supportive force in my life. You've given me so many opportunities to learn and grow, just like this one here today, and I will be forever grateful for everything that you've done to inspire me as a musician and as a learner. Thank you so much.
I should pay you for saying that. They agree. Wow. All right. So I did promise Evelyn that live on air she could tell a bad Halloween joke, although hers is better than mine. So I'm going to go first with my really cheesy Halloween joke that those of you who are here for the pre-show have not heard. When is it bad luck to be followed by a black cat? When you're a mouse.
Very nice.
You got a better one?
I don't know if it's better, but I have one.
Okay.
Why do werewolves never know the time? Because they're not when-wolves. Duh.
Clap. Okay, we got a few claps. Yes, for our listeners at home, I know that you tuned in just for these jokes. All right, now we are going to do a version of Paganini's Witch's Dance. It actually starts with the original Suzuki tune, but Evelyn, being immensely creative, has composed her very own cadenza, which is where a violinist plays all by themselves in the middle of this, and I'm very impressed with what she came up with. So, on with the show. Let's do it.
Thank you.
Isn't that great? Well-deserved applause. Nice job. Wasn't that a nice cadenza? So, I guess this will be recorded, so you don't have to write it down. You can remember it. Well, up next, you get to hear percussion again. I know you've been waiting. Yes, see, John, they love you. Wow. Yeah. Stealing the show, I say. I would like to take a minute to tell you about Karen Savage. She's amazing. She puts up with all of my crazy. You know, as a pianist, she is not only a collaborator and works with me, and we come up with our own unique concept of things, but other times I think she's just like, sure. Secretly, she's like, oh my God. Probably not. She's very kind. But I thought she could tell you a little bit about collaborative piano. She is associate professor of it at the UMKC Conservatory, coordinator of chamber music as well. And you hold a doctoral and two master's degrees from Juilliard. Dang, I didn't know you had two master's degrees. You're legit. She's legit. Okay, I'll stop talking. Would you love to tell us about collaborative piano playing now?
Sure. So you know how John talked about being a percussionist is about loving to play with toys. And I think for collaborative piano, it's about loving to play with other musicians. So pianists can get kind of lonely. And so I have gotten to play with violin, flute, oboe, and last month's voice and oboe, and cello. And it's really, I've never played with an Aztec death whistle before tonight, before this last couple of weeks, but it really expands your horizons. It helps you listen to different colors, and it's wonderful to make conversations with friends and to, you know, within the case of art song, to delve into poetry, and it's been a wonderful. I did my first master's in solo piano, and then I realized that I wanted to do more work with collaborative piano. So that's actually what we started a new program there at UMKC. And because most pianists actually end up coming out of school and they get a lot of their living from playing with other people, so we might as well learn how to do it well and listen well and know our roles and listen to articulations. So that's it. And I have a viola joke.
Oh, you have a viola joke?
Okay.
Yes!
So what is the difference between a viola and an onion?
Uh-oh.
Nobody cries when you chop up the...
Ah! Are there any violists in the audience?
No more collaboration.
Yeah, I know. That was good. The poor viola ends up always being the butt of every orchestral joke, but actually we do have a violist in the audience, but I won't embarrass that person. Thank you, Karen. Yeah, that was funny. Good job. This next tune you all probably will recognize. It is Sasson's Danse Macabre. It is actually originally for a solo violin with orchestra, and the solo violinist tunes their E string down, so they usually have a different violin to play on, and it creates a tritone. And back in the ancient times when they had Gregorian chant and whatnot, the tritone was thought of as the instrument of the devil because it created such a spooky sound. Trains have a tritone whistle, ambulance sirens have it, so it's a startling sound. This is based on writings in a poem, an allegory in the late Middle Ages. It's about the dance of death. And the poem that Sassans wrote it to starts with the clock striking 12 at midnight, and death appears and tries to get all of the living beings to join him in the grave, and skeletons dance. And really the actual sort of charming part to the story, although a bit maudlin, is that, you know, kings and paupers and workers and everyone show up, but we're all equal in death, right? When you're 6 feet under, there's no more. Yeah, okay, it's getting a little, yeah. Happy Halloween, everybody! So one of my favorite parts in this, it actually sounds like a carnival of, and I just imagine glass dolls like ratcheting their teeth and like moving their head around. For those of you at home, I'm cracking my head open right now. It's just, there's so much color in this, and Karen has to represent the whole orchestra on piano. And John has taken some of the percussion parts from orchestra and then also added his own flair to it. So I think you'll enjoy this version. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Assisted by Kansas City musicians, percussionist John Curry, pianist Karen Savage, and Kansas Public Radio's own evening classical host, the violinist Destiny Ann Mermegan. This was their fun Halloween show that topped off KPR's Live Day 2023 in the pavilion of KU's Lead Center. It was broadcast live on October 25th, 2023. Recording the show were KPR sound engineers Jason Sloat and Chubb Smith. They were assisted by Cam Sloat. I'm Cordelia Brown. Thanks for joining us for Classics Live, a weekly look at the best local classical events. Broadcasts of Classics Live are a production of Kansas Public Radio. And if you'd like to hear this show again or share it with a friend, check our website, KansasPublicRadio.org. You know, when your old boat feels like an anchor around your wallet, KPR's vehicle donation program is here for you. We'll take your donated vehicle and use it to fund the programs you enjoy every day. Donate your boat, car, or motorcycle at KansasPublicRadio.org. Everyone can leave a gift to KPR through their will. It's an inspired way to support an organization that enriches your life and that of others in your community. Learn more about leaving a legacy gift to KPR at legacy.kansaspublicradio.org. This is KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV, KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, and KANQ Chanute, kansaspublicradio.org.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. During a swing through Pennsylvania today, Vice President Harris made one of her final campaign stops in Allentown. Julian Abraham of member station WLVR is more.
At Muhlenberg College, Harris spoke to a room full of mostly students, many voting for the first time.
America is ready for a fresh start. Love to see you. And America is ready for a new way forward where we see our fellow American not as an enemy, but as a neighbor.
Harris emphasized reproductive rights, vowed to reduce the cost of living, and addressed Latino voters, a population that makes up more than half of Allentown. Opening acts included salsa singer Frankie Negron, rapper Fat Joe, and Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. The rally was briefly interrupted by a pro-Palestinian protester. She was removed by Secret Service. For NPR News, I'm Julian Abraham in Allentown.
In what amounts to an election eve sprint, Republican Donald Trump is also in Pennsylvania. He's making four stops in three states, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Michigan today. Speaking in Pittsburgh, Trump told rallygoers he will fix a broken Washington.
Together we will save this country. We will defeat the corrupt system in Washington, and America's future will be an absolutely incredible one. That's what it is.
Trump led the night in Philadelphia. Polls in Pennsylvania with 19 electoral votes show the candidates in a statistical dead heat. Harris is also in Pittsburgh tonight. The Harris campaign is holding streaming Get Out the Vote event involving all seven battleground states. Social media researchers are warning the public to be extra careful about content related to the election. As NPR's Bobby Allen explains, it's in part because platforms have rolled back protection since the presidential contest in 2020.
Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter all cracked down on election misinformation after the chaos surrounding the 2020 election. But the platforms have since loosened their rules. Facebook and Instagram say they police political ads less now. YouTube is no longer taking down videos falsely claiming the 2024 election has been rigged. And Twitter, now X, has become a playground for conspiracy theories and false claims about the election. Researchers fear false claims of voter fraud and exaggerated claims of voter irregularities could spur real-world unrest or violence. It also has prompted experts to underscore just how cautious social media users should be before believing or sharing election-related content. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
The Federal Reserve Board's rate-setting open market committee meets this week in Washington. It's widely expected when the Fed meeting concludes, policymakers will announce another interest rate cut. The expected quarter of a point cut, the second this year since the Fed began easing rates. Stocks drifted lower today on Wall Street. The Dow fell 257 points. This is NPR.
Stardate November 2nd. Many people gripe when we spring forward in March at the start of daylight saving time. And many studies suggest they have reason to complain. For a few days after the switch, there's an uptick in car accidents, workplace injuries, and even heart attacks. And a recent study shows other consequences: more junk food and less time at the gym. Daylight saving time is observed across most of the United States and more than 70 other countries. Originally, it was designed to save energy. By advancing the clock an hour during the longer days of summer, people would go to bed not long after dark, so they wouldn't use as much electricity in the evenings. But it's not clear if it really does save energy. Today, the big advantage is seen as recreational. People can spend more time outdoors. But the loss of sleep seems to cause problems. The new study, for example, looked at how people changed their health habits the day of the switch. Researchers found that people ate more junk food. The number of junk food calories went up by about half. The effect was especially pronounced in the evenings and when the day of the change was cloudy. And the total time people spent at fitness centers went down by a third, especially among those who didn't work out often or lived farther from the gym. The study found there was no impact from falling back, as we'll do tonight, as daylight saving time ends for another year. McDonald Observatory offers star parties, tours, and other programs for visitors. Details at mcdonaldobservatory.org. And for the McDonald Observatory, I'm Billy Henry.
We hope that you are enjoying the jazz on this public radio station. Thank you for your support.